Chapter 17. I had to look after Thompson, and I applied myself, of course, in the first instance, to discovering where he was. Now, Thompson's wife lived, along with a little daughter, a Chelsea. Knowing that Thompson was somewhere in the country, I watched the house especially at post time in the morning thinking Thompson was pretty likely to write to her. Sure enough, one morning the postman comes up, and delivers a letter at Mrs. Thompson's door. Little girl opens the door, and takes it in. We're not always sure of postmen, though the people at the post offices are always very obliging. A postman may help us, or he may not, just as it happens. However, I go across the road, and I say to the postman, after he has left the letter, "Good morning, how are you?" "How are you?" says he. "You've just delivered a letter for Mrs. Thompson." "Yes, I have." "You didn't happen to remark what the postmark was, perhaps?" "No," says he, "I didn't." "Come," says I, "I'll be plain with you. I'm in a small way of business, and I have given Thompson credit, and I can't afford to lose what he owes me. I know he's got money, and I know he's in the country, and if you could tell me what the postmark was, I should be very much obliged to you, and you do a service to a tradesman in a small way of business that can't afford a loss." "Well," he said, "I do assure you that I did not observe what the postmark was. All I know is that there was money in the letter, I should say a sovereign." This was enough for me, because of course I knew that Thompson having sent his wife money, it was probable she'd write to Thompson, by return of post, to acknowledge the receipt. So I said thank you to the postman, and I kept on the watch. In the afternoon I saw the little girl come out. Of course I followed her. She went into a stationer's shop, and I needn't say to you that I looked in at the window. She bought some writing paper and envelopes, and a pen. I think to myself, that'll do. Watch her home again, and don't go away, you may be sure, knowing that Mrs. Thompson was writing her letter to Tally-ho, and that the letter would be posted presently. In about an hour or so, out came the little girl again, with the letter in her hand. I went up, and said something to the child, whatever it might have been. But I couldn't see the direction of the letter, because she held it with the seal upwards. However, I observed that on the back of the letter there was what we call a kiss, a drop of wax by the side of the seal, and again, you understand, that was enough for me. I saw her post the letter, waited till she was gone, then went into the shop, and asked to see the master. When he came out, I told him, "Now, I'm an officer in the detective force. There's a letter with a kiss, been posted here just now, for a man, that I'm in search of, and what I have to ask of you, is, that you will let me look at the direction of that letter." He was very civil, took a lot of letters from the box in the window, shook them out on the counter with the faces downwards, and there among them was the identical letter with the kiss. It was directed, "Mr. Thomas Pigeon, Post Office, B, to be left till called for." Down I went to B, 120 miles or so, that night. Early next morning I went to the post office, saw the gentleman in charge of that department, told him who I was, and that my object was to see, and track, the party that should come for the letter for Mr. Thomas Pigeon. He was very polite, and said, "You shall have every assistance we can give you. You can wait inside the office, and we'll take care to let you know when anybody comes for the letter." Well, I waited there 3 days, and began to think that nobody ever would come. At last the clerk whispered to me, "Here, detective, somebody's come for the letter." "Keep him a minute," said I, and I ran round to the outside of the office. There I saw a young chap with the appearance of an ostler, holding a horse by the bridle, stretching the bridle across the pavement, while he waited at the post office window for the letter. I began to pat the horse, and that, and I said to the boy, "Why, this is Mr. Jones' mare." "No, it ain't." "No?" said one. "She's very like Mr. Jones' mare." "She ain't Mr. Jones' mare, anyhow," says he. It's Mr. So-and-so's, of the work arms. And up he jumped, and off he went, letter and all. I got a cab, followed on the box, and was so quick after him, that I came into the stable yard of the work arms, by one gate, just as he came in by another. I went into the bar, where there was a young woman serving, and called for a glass of brandy and water. He came in directly, and handed her the letter. She casually looked at it, without saying anything, and stuck it up behind the glass over the chimney piece. What was to be done next? I turned it over in my mind, while I drank my brandy and water, looking pretty sharp at the letter the while, but I couldn't see my way out of it at all. I tried to get lodgings in the house, but there had been a horse fair, or something of that sort, and it was full. I was obliged to put up somewhere else, but I came backwards and forwards to the bar for a couple of days, and there was the letter always behind the glass. At last I thought I'd write a letter to Mr. Pigeon myself, and see what that would do. So I wrote one, and posted it, but I purposely addressed it, Mr. John Pigeon, instead of Mr. Thomas Pigeon, to see what that would do. In the morning, a very wet morning it was, I watched the postman down the street, and cut into the bar, just before he reached the Warwick Arms. And he came presently with my letter. Is there a Mr. John Pigeon staying here? No. Stop a bit though, says the barmaid. And she took down the letter behind the glass. No, says she, it's Thomas, and he is not staying here. Would you do me a favor, and post this for me, as it is so wet? The postman said yes. She folded it in another envelope, directed it, and gave it him. He put it in his hat, and away he went. I had no difficulty in finding out the direction of that letter. It was addressed Mr. Thomas Pigeon. Post office, R, Northamptonshire, to be left till called for. Off I started directly for R. I said the same at the post office there, as I had said at B, and again I waited 3 days before anybody came. At last another chap on horseback came. Any letters for Mr. Thomas Pigeon? Where do you come from? New Inn, near R. He got the letter, and away he went at a canter. I made my inquiries about the new inn, near R, and hearing it was a solitary sort of house, a little in the horse line, about a couple of miles from the station, I thought I'd go, and have a look at it. I found it what it had been described, and sauntered in, to look about me. The landlady was in the bar, and I was trying to get into conversation with her. Asked her how business was, and spoke about the wet weather, and so on. When I saw, through an open door, three men sitting by the fire in a sort of parlor, or kitchen, and one of those men, according to the description I had of him, was Tally-ho Thompson. I went and sat down among them, and tried to make things agreeable, but they were very shy, wouldn't talk at all, looked at me, and at one another, in a way quite the reverse of sociable. I reckoned them up, and finding that they were all three bigger men than me, and considering that their looks were ugly, that it was a lonely place, railroad station 2 miles off, and night coming on, thought I couldn't do better than have a drop of brandy and water to keep my courage up. So I called for my brandy and water, and as I was sitting drinking it by the fire, Thompson got up and went out. Now the difficulty of it was, that I wasn't sure it was Thompson, because I had never set eyes on him before, and what I had wanted was to be quite certain of him. However, there was nothing for it now, but to follow, and put a bold face upon it. I found him talking, outside in the yard, with the landlady. It turned out afterwards, that he was wanted by a Northampton officer for something else, and that, knowing that officer to be pockmarked as I am myself, he mistook me for him. As I have observed, I found him talking to the landlady, outside. I put my hand upon his shoulder this way and said, Tally-ho Thompson, it's no use. I know you. I'm an officer from London, and I take you into custody for felony. That be DD, says Tally-ho Thompson. We went back into the house, and the two friends began to cut up rough, and their looks didn't please me at all, I assure you. Let the man go. What are you going to do with him? I'll tell you what I'm going to do with him. I'm going to take him to London tonight, as sure as I'm alive. I'm not alone here, whatever you may think. You mind your own business, and keep yourselves to yourselves. It'll be better for you, for I know you both very well. I'd never seen or heard of them in all my life, but my bouncing cowed them a bit, and they kept off, while Thompson was making ready to go. I thought to myself, however, that they might be coming after me on the dark road, to rescue Thompson. So I said to the landlady, "What men have you got in the house, missus?" "We haven't got no men here," she says, sulkily. "You have got an ostler, I suppose?" "Yes, we've got an ostler. Let me see him." Presently he came, and a shaggy-headed young fellow he was. "Now attend to me, young man," says I. "I'm a detective officer from London. This man's name is Thompson. I have taken him into custody for felony. I am going to take him to the railroad station. I call upon you in the Queen's name to assist me. And mind you, my friend, you'll get yourself into more trouble than you know of, if you don't." You never saw a person open his eyes so wide. "Now, Thompson, come along," says one. But when I took out the handcuffs, Thompson cries, "No, none of that. I won't stand them. I'll go along with you quiet, but I won't bear none of that." "Tally-ho, Thompson," I said, "I'm willing to behave as a man to you, if you are willing to behave as a man to me. Give me your word that you will come peaceably along, and I don't want to handcuff you." "I will," says Thompson, "but I'll have a glass of brandy first." "I don't care if I've another," said one. "We'll have two more, missus," said the friends, "and confound you, constable, you'll give your man a drop, won't you?" I was agreeable to that, so we had it all round, and then my man, and I took Tally-ho Thompson safe to the railroad, and I carried him to London that night. He was afterwards acquitted, on account of a defect in the evidence, and I understand he always praises me up to the skies, and says I'm one of the best of men. This story coming to a termination amidst general applause, Inspector Weald, after a little grave smoking, fixes his eye on his host, and thus delivers himself. "It wasn't a bad plant that of mine, on Fikey, the man accused of forging the Sioux Western Railway debentures. It was only t'other day, because the reason why? I'll tell you. I had information that Fikey and his brother kept a factory over yonder there," indicating any region on the Surrey side of the river, "where he bought second-hand carriages. So after I'd tried in vain to get hold of him by other means, I wrote him a letter in an assumed name, saying that I'd got a horse and shay to dispose of, and would drive down next day, that he might view the lot, and make an offer very reasonable. It was, I said, a reglar bargain. Straw and me then went off to a friend of mine that's in the livery and job business, and hired a turnout for the day, a precious smart turnout. It was quite a slap-up thing. Down we drove, accordingly, with a friend who's not in the force himself, and leaving my friend in the shay near a public house, to take care of the horse, we went to the factory, which was some little way off. In the factory, there was a number of strong fellows at work, and after reckoning them up, it was clear to me that it wouldn't do to try it on there. They were too many for us. We must get our man out of doors. Mr. Fikey at home? No, he ain't. Expected home soon? Why, no, not soon. Ah, is his brother here? I'm his brother. Oh, well, this is an ill convenience, this is. I wrote him a letter yesterday, saying I'd got a little turnout to dispose of, and I've took the trouble to bring the turnout down a purpose, and now he ain't in the way. No, he ain't in the way. You couldn't make it convenient to call again, could you? Why, no, I couldn't. I want to sell, that's the fact, and I can't put it off. Could you find him anywheres? At first he said no, he couldn't, and then he wasn't sure about it, and then he'd go and try. So at last he went upstairs, where there was a sort of loft, and presently down comes my man himself in his shirt sleeves. Well, he says, this seems to be rather a pressing matter of yours. Yes, I says, it is rather a pressing matter, and you'll find it a bargain dirt cheap. I ain't in particular want of a bargain just now, he says, but where is it? Why, I says, the turnout's just outside. Come and look at it. He hasn't any suspicions, and away we go. And the first thing that happens is, that the horse runs away with my friend, who knows no more of driving than a child, when he takes a little trot along the road to show his paces. You never saw such a game in your life. When the bolt is over, and the turnout has come to a standstill again, Fikey walks round, and round it as grave as a judge me to. There, sir, I says. There's a neat thing. It ain't a bad style of thing, he says. I believe you, says one. And there's a horse. For I saw him looking at it. Rising 8, I says, rubbing his 4 legs. Bless you, there ain't a man in the world knows less of horses than I do, but I'd heard my friend at the livery stable say he was 8 year old, so I says, as knowing as possible rising 8. Rising 8, is he? Says he. Rising 8, says one. Well, he says, what do you want for it? Why, the first and last figure for the whole concern is 5 and 20 pound. That's very cheap. He says, looking at me. Ain't it? I says. I told you it was a bargain. Now, without any higgling and haggling about it, what I want is to sell, and that's my price. Further, I'll make it easy to you, and take half the money down, and you can do a bit of stiff one, for the balance. Well, he says again, that's very cheap. I believe you, says I. Get in and try it, and you'll buy it. Come. Take a trial. Ecod, he gets in, and we get in, and we drive along the road, to show him to one of the railway clerks that was hid in the public house window to identify him. But the clerk was bothered, and didn't know whether it was him, or wasn't, because the reason why. I'll tell you, on account of his having shaved his whiskers. It's a clever little horse, he says, and trots well, and the shay runs light. Not a doubt about it, I says. And now, Mr. Fikey, I may as well make it all right, without wasting any more of your time. The fact is, I'm Inspector Weald, and you're my prisoner. You don't mean that? He says. I do, indeed. Then burn my body, says Fikey, if this ain't too bad. Perhaps you never saw a man so knocked over with surprise. I hope you'll let me have my coat, he says. By all means. Well then, let's drive to the factory. Why, not exactly that, I think, said I. I've been there, once before, today. Suppose we send for it. He saw it was no go, so he sent for it, and put it on, and we drove him up to London, comfortable. Apostrophe, this reminiscence is in the height of its success, when a general proposal is made to the fresh-complexioned, smooth-faced officer, with a strange air of simplicity, to tell the butcher's story. Apostrophe, the fresh-complexioned, smooth-faced officer, with a strange air of simplicity, began with a rustic smile, and in a soft, wheedling tone of voice, to relate the butcher's story, thus. It's just about 6 years ago now, since information was given at Scotland Yard of there being extensive robberies of lawns and silks going on, at some wholesale houses in the city. Directions were given for the business being looked into, and Straw, and Fendel, and me, we were all in it. Apostrophe, when you received your instructions, apostrophe said we, you went away, and held a sort of cabinet council together. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the smooth-faced officer coaxingly replied, yes, just so. We turned it over among ourselves a good deal. It appeared, when we went into it, that the goods were sold by the receivers extraordinarily cheap, much cheaper than they could have been if they had been honestly come by. The receivers were in the trade, and kept capital shops establishments of the first respectability, one of 'em at the West End, one down in Westminster. After a lot of watching and inquiry, and this and that among ourselves, we found that the job was managed, and the purchases of the stolen goods made, at a little public house near Smithfield, down by St. Bartholomew's, where the warehouse porters, who were the thieves, took them for that purpose, don't you see? And made appointments to meet the people that went between themselves and the receivers. This public house was principally used by journeymen butchers from the country, out of place, and in want of situations. So, what did we do? But we agreed that I should be dressed up like a butcher myself, and go and live there. Never, surely, was a faculty of observation better brought to bear. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.